Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. I'm happy to have Maristone Island resident Rita Kepner with us today to talk about her recently published book, Through Fire and Water, True Stories of Rita Marie Matthiessen, as told to Laura Callender, will be our topic of discussion, as will be her amazingly adventurous life. Welcome to the show, Rita.
Thank you very much, Sheila.
I'd like to start by listing from your bio, from your extended bio, the number of different professional capacities you have worked in your life. Journalist, teacher, FEMA worker who responded to disasters. You even held a captain's license for a while up until 2011 and skippered boats for tourist boating businesses. And somehow you've decided to write as well. And so a lot of your writing has been nonfiction. And then you also have awards for your photojournalism. You published a short story called A Christmas Guitar, which was fiction, which was a diversion from your nonfiction. And now you've written an autobiographical book about your adventurous life. So, and you're also a sculptor who has had exhibitions in many countries, I think six around the world. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a lot to have accomplished. And I'm wondering what drew you to this adventurous life. And I'm sure that influences why you wrote the book about your adventures. So anything you'd like to tell us would be very welcome.
Well, thank you. I think that part of it all kind of circles around in on itself. My guess is that I led an adventurous life because I learned very young, at about 3 and a half, that life is a gift. And I just lived it. I also was fortunate to be born in a country that encourages education. I was able to get an education, and I had a family that supported my doing that. So all those things came together. I just lived.
And how do you ascribe that to being 3 and a half? Do you have a particular memory?
That is, and that memory was part of the inspiration for getting the stories captured in this book, because I almost died in a fire when I was 3 and a half, and I was intensely aware of what was going on around me, and I'm not sure that that's normal for a 3 and a half, but I think that intense emotional experiences do sear themselves on one's brain. So somehow I learned early on to know that life was precious. And then I came away also somehow intuitively knowing that intense experiences could be a very good thing.
My question to you when I read your book was about the fact that it is your story, but it's told in the third person. So that you're Rita in the book, not I. And it's told to another person, and you are a writer. So I'm very curious about that process. Why, with this material, did you choose a pen name, an as-told-to person, and the third person?
I do get that question a lot. Yes, I know how to write, and I also value the craft and skills of writing. It takes me forever to do a good paragraph because I value it. I had had so many intense experiences. Back when I was in college, I remember reading Joseph Conrad, and that somehow stuck with me, maybe because he was also of Polish heritage, but he was a writer who lived an incredibly full, rich, active, adventurous life, and then settled down to write about it. And I thought, well, that's a good way to go. I could just live and then later write about it. And then I had other experiences where I saw people who I valued and loved live incredibly good lives, but never get it written down. Even I remember reading Hemingway said that, oh my goodness, I'm running out of time, and he jotted down notes in Movable Feast about all the stories that he hadn't gotten to tell yet, he hadn't gotten to capture. And I just decided at one point, largely because of people kept telling me, oh, that's a great story. Have you written that down? You need to write that down. Or, oh, that's an amazing thing. Have you written that down? And I just didn't, because I have been and I still am too busy being and doing, and I love to be in the moment and enjoy my life. And I wasn't getting those stories written down. So I finally agreed, with the help of some badgering friends, to try another way so that at least I capture the stories which are important to me, that I felt like they might be inspirational to other women especially. So I wanted to capture the stories, and then I still feel I'm young enough. I have time. If I run out of energy for the adventuring and I need to sit down, I can still write some more. And if I want, I can rewrite it. But I haven't missed the opportunity to capture and write down some of these stories, or have written down in this case. And also, I like to talk. You know, I like to tell stories. I like to share them one-on-one with my friends, with people, and see some feedback and some interaction. So this solved a lot of problems in that funny little puzzle of my life.
How did you find the right person to tell the story to who could then write it?
Well, that's an interesting, you know, how serendipity works. Years back, when Peninsula Daily News had a really good writer, which happened to be Laura Colander, who was going around and finding women on the peninsula and writing special stories. They had a series for a couple of years. It was wonderful. She looked hard to find interesting people. And she showed up on my doorstep one day and wanted to interview me, and I was a little taken aback, but she did. And when she got done with that interview and I read it, and other people kept coming up to me, oh, that was amazing, that was amazing, I realized that she was a really good listener, that she got it, the sense and emotions of the stories I was telling, and she could capture them well and write them down. So she was the one that I thought of, and lo and behold, she had some time when I had some time, so we just got together over a couple of months and
made it happen. So I was going to ask you, how long did the process take? A couple of months of giving her the stories?
Yeah. She would come, and we'd sit and, you know, have tea and chat and share stories, and she'd take notes, and she'd go away, and she'd pull up wonderful drafts, and then we'd work on those a while together. Back and forth we'd go, and then she'd get some more stories, and then we had to decide how to put them together, because she was being the craftsman, and I valued that because, I valued her skill and craftsmanship in writing. She's very good. So we just worked back and forth together. I understand the skills and know the skills, so that she was happy to work with me, because we weren't speaking any odd language. It was maybe the secret language of writers, but it's
which
not,
can be odd.
It can be odd, but we communicated. Yeah. So it was
like a collaboration.
It was a wonderful collaboration.
Right. It's so nice to meet the right person to collaborate with. Things are effortless then, even the hard things.
Even the hard things.
Just keep moving through.
Yeah.
So what was a hard thing about the process?
From the craftsmanship point of view, editing, that's always the hard part. Reviewing, rereading, re-editing. From the storytelling part, there were some emotional places that were sometimes painful, sometimes elating. You know, some intense emotions that occasionally I'd have to stop and step back a minute and realize that I hadn't thought much about some of those things for a long time. And it was helpful. You know, it's always good to revisit your past.
Right, and that's what writing does. It makes us live it twice.
Or three or four or 78 if you're editing. Right.
We do keep moving on in life, and writing does make us stop and pause and reflect and feel again, especially if we're writing well or telling the story well. We're there. We're back. We're living. As you said, you like to keep on living. Mm-hmm. And in writing, we are reliving.
Yes.
But it's as if now. So I totally understand the emotional part. And what motivated the decision to tell the story in the third person?
We talked about that a lot. Primarily, I was honoring her talent and skill, Laura's, because if we did it together and I put it in the first person, then it sounds like she wasn't there. And I wanted her to be there. She was there. It was very important. So it was a tribute and an honor to her skill.
A way that it could become both your book.
Yes.
And then finally, the pen name. Why did you use a pen name?
Well, I had kept my first husband's name because my original name was Rita Kramenitz. It's a Polish name. And I was married earlier to a Bill Kepner. I took that name. I was in my early 20s. And I managed to develop a pretty good following as a sculptor under that name, Kepner. So when he and I split up, and then several years later, John and I got together. I maintained the name Kepner. I still carry it because most people know me that way, and my reputation as a sculptor and even primarily as a writer is under Rita Kepner. So I keep that name. But this was a book that kind of was in his time and space. We took up the whole house for several months. John? Yeah, that's his name, Matthiessen. And I thought this was a nice place.
This is your current husband.
That's my current husband, John Matthiessen. I thought this was a good place to put his name and use his name and honor our relationship together in a way that wasn't easy or convenient for the rest of my life. So this, I thought, was a good way.
Yeah. And this book sounds like it was very inclusive of your almost co-writer and inclusive of your present husband and inclusive of your amazing background. So I know you came prepared to read a little bit. Would this be a good time to hear an excerpt from one of the stories in the book?
Well, you said 2 minutes, so I have a very brief selection picked out, and you'll see it's sort of the beginning of why there's a book. This fear was not something with which she could reason. In front of them was the only way out of that inferno, but they could not see beyond the third or fourth step down. Somewhere down there was either the doorway to life or the entrance to death. The possibility of life or death for the 3.5-year-old girl and the 20-something firefighter was the same. Descending into the abyss with hopes and prayers meant a chance, their only chance of surviving. The firefighter shifted the child in his arms to get a better view over her head and began a rapid descent. The sound of splintering wood fell on her ears, and she bounced in his arms as the man's boots crashed through the stairs. Somehow, he managed to stay upright, swinging one leg out just in time to keep from falling all the way through the stairs to the floor below. He arrived at the bottom step, almost on his knees. He jostled his bundle again, her head bumping into his chest. The smell of sweat and smoke mingled together, and she forced the stench out of her nostrils. She held her breath, trying not to take in the stink of burning vinyl, carpeting, and wood. The firefighter took 3 stumbling steps forward and pushed through the screen door out into the yard.
Phew. I can see listening to this why the third person is a good choice, because not only does it include both of you as writers, it really does feel to the reader, to the listener or reader, that we're being told a story. And there's more room in this story for the narrator to know what was happening inside the head of the fireman, for instance, or what the surroundings were like, broader than the 3.5-year-old might have been able to tell it. I understand that choice now.
I felt that exactly. She could bring in picture details that the mind of the child could not bring in. Even though she got the picture details from me telling the story, we worked together, she would say, well, what was it like? What was going on? What did you see? What did you hear? So as we collaborated, it allowed us both to bring in the emotion and bring in those outside craft details that bring the story alive.
I think so, too.
You are tuned to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, Washington. You are listening to In Conversation, discussions on writing and the writing life with Sheila Bender, a bi-monthly chat with writers, publishers, and those who support the literary arts. Today, Sheila Bender is talking with Marrowstone Island resident Rita Kepner about her novel, Through Fire and Water, True Stories of Rita Marie Matthiessen, as told to Laura Callender.
So, you're 3.5 years old. You have this life-altering event of a fire and survival and knowing that life is a gift and you're going to live it. One door was life and one door was death is also kind of metaphorical as well. It's very real in that situation, but it's also philosophical and spiritual.
Yes.
So this child chooses life rather than fear after having been through this. And what happens to her? I don't know that the stories cover all of this, of course, but what happens to her in her school years before she's an adult who can accomplish all of the careers that you've had?
That's too big of a question, sorry, because my school years went from there at 3.5. I didn't finish my PhD until 5 years ago, so pretty big question.
All right, but you know what I mean. I mean, while she was living at home, say.
Well, first of all, a critical detail that we go to fairly soon on is that the reason that the firefighter was hauling me out of this burning building was because my parents forgot me. Pretty big emotional reality. And I got it. They forgot me. But I knew there was no negativity of the slightest sort around the fact that they forgot me. Some of this is explained a little more if you get to read the book. But my dad owned this little hotel on the shores of Lake Ontario. One of the guests had fallen asleep with a cigarette. And when it was obvious the building was on fire, my dad went around, make sure everybody was out of the building. My mom scooped up my baby sister, and they both sort of assumed that each other of them had gotten me. I was sound asleep in my little bed.
I remember that vivid description where you don't even realize that the fireman is there to rescue from a fire.
No, I thought he was a monster. Yeah.
Right. Which I'm sure he looked like in his big boots and heavy
clothing. Well, in those days, we're talking a long time ago now. This was in the, what was it, barely 1950. They used these big, long tubes to breathe through. So he had this huge helmet with a big, long tube in front where they can go into burning buildings and not die themselves of smoke. It's different now. They have breathers and oxygen, all kinds of things. But in those days,
it really looked
much
like
simpler.
A monster.
Huge monster. Yeah. Big, heavy, right. Asbestos coat. Yeah.
So it's not exactly that they forgot you. It's that they made this assumption and didn't check with each other.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but what is it that you got? You said, I got it.
Well, first of all, I knew that number one, they had left me. I knew that they didn't do it through any malice. At some level, although I don't think that was clarified until I was well into my adulthood, I realized that they had made assumptions that I was incredibly capable, that I would make it. Baby sister was just a baby, so she wasn't capable. She couldn't do that by herself. So somehow I would be okay. Either one or the other of us of them would get me, or I'd get myself, but I'd be okay.
And so that's how you
that's
knew
how I lived my life.
Yeah. So tell us about that life, and as it's reflected in the stories, is there another excerpt you'd like to read to show us more of life, or you want to just tell us?
Well, you know, that's up to you.
Well, we have time.
Yeah, well, actually, I didn't pick another excerpt for you, but I can probably, honestly, random.
That would be really fun. Just point to a paragraph.
Okay. "What's wrong with you, girl?" he hissed. "You ain't supposed to drink from the colored's fountain. Ain't you got no sense?" Stunned, Rita fled back to the car, covering the sting in her cheek with her hand. While other children may have learned the lesson that there were different drinking fountains for whites and blacks, Rita took away a different lesson. Don't drink out of public fountains, and stay away from grumpy old men. Ed Wilson, her black sculptor instructor's studio, had a handful of intriguing sculptures and paintings in addition to his own works. Several were by African artists. One of his favorite pieces was a contemporary, Esram League, from Johannesburg. Rita held the small abstract in her hands, feeling the smoothness of one area juxtapose against the rough opposite side. The art from the dark continent was so unlike anything produced in Europe or in the United States. Rita marveled over the extreme feelings of the artwork stirred within her. Until she had met Ed Wilson, Rita had heard nothing of artists in Africa. "Who'd have thunk it?" she quipped to fellow classmates one morning as they set up for their sculpture class. "As far as anyone in America knew, that continent doesn't even exist, let alone have artists creating such amazing art."
And how old is Rita in this story?
Probably 20, in college. And I was in college in upstate New York. This was in the 60s, so that's why I got whomped for drinking out of the wrong colored fountain on a little trip to the South. This was a whole new phenomenon. I mean, definitely relates to the things that are going on today. We've progressed, but we haven't progressed a lot. I hadn't known black people up until I met Ed Wilson, who had been brought to our, you know, liberal college, and he was our token black. And he wasn't very black. He was a kind of a passing white. I guess that made it more comfortable for everybody. I don't know. But that's what I thought later on as I began to assess that in my mind. And my world continued to broaden.
So this was a visit to his actual studio?
Yes.
In the South, as opposed to where he was a visiting
teacher? No, the studio that where I was talking about was there at the college in New York.
Oh.
And the adventure of realizing that we had so much prejudice in the United States occurred in a separate trip. Wait, I'd move from one trip to another in those between those two paragraphs. A high school friend of mine allowed me to join them to a trip to Mexico, which was another one of my adventures. I went along with them, and on the ride down to Mexico, as we traveled through the South, we're driving in a car. We stopped one day and to get gas as we were driving, and I was thirsty, and I just got out of the car, and oh, there's a drinking fountain, went and took a drink. I mean, this was news to me. I didn't know. I didn't know anything about prejudice. I hadn't seen it in my life before that. I was completely unfamiliar with what I heard described yesterday as raw hate. Raw hate was, I didn't know it. It was a big learning experience.
Absolutely. Your life continues to get more and more involved, actually, with the intersections of history. Mm-hmm. So at what age are you when you are doing the FEMA disaster response work?
At that point now, I'm a mother, a wife. I've got a job. I'm cutting back on my artwork because I couldn't feed my family on that income. I needed a sort of a real job. And I stumbled into, partially because I'd done Vista Volunteer, I had sort of credits to be able to apply for a federal job. I got a federal job, ironically, I thought, with the Army Corps of Engineers. But I gravitated immediately to their response work in floods, and that led me to semi-volunteer, quasi-volunteer with FEMA. FEMA has a reservist system still, although it's changed a lot since I participated. So I could do that kind of volunteer work, semi-paid, because it was paid when you were on duty. You got hourly, so there was some, and expenses paid, so you didn't have to pay your own airfare. I just gravitated to that and realized while I was doing that FEMA work, and now I'm talking, I'm in my 30s, late 30s and moving into my early 40s. I got there, I realized, because of the fire when I was 3 and a half. When I sat in my living room here in Maristone Island when the Oklahoma City bombing occurred and saw that firefighter carrying the child who then died out of the burning building, I flashed back. I knew that that was why I was in that role. Mm-hmm. And it was really emotional. It was really hard for me to go to that site and help people. But it was also just, it felt like I had to be there. That's how I got to doing that sort of work, and I continued to do it.
You said you had a job. Did you also have a job in addition to leaving for the emergencies?
I moved through a lot of adventures in jobs. I worked for the Corps of Engineers for a while. I moved to Europe and got a job offer in Europe, and I was a newspaper editor for a couple of Army papers for the people who were serving overseas. And I just worked my way back to the United States and at one point decided to stop the federal jobs, and I worked here in Port Townsend for a Community Action Council in early childhood education. For a lot of reasons, I decided that they needed my salary for the children, so I actually resigned from that position so that more of that money could go to serve the kids that needed serving. I signed up for this temporary on-call reservist task. That let me be home more because now my son was growing. He was in kindergarten, first grade, and I really wanted to be home a lot more than I was getting to be with the full-time jobs that I had. So this allowed me to be home when I was home, but intensely on duty when I was on duty.
Absolutely, intensely.
Mm-hmm.
So with all of your achievements, and they are achievements, you might call them living. From someone listening, I would say they're achievements. How does it feel to have this between two book covers in your book?
I'm really glad to have the stories captured. And I do think that in the future, I can do some more writing in my own voice. I've had a lot of friends really encourage me to, hey, but you didn't tell, because there's, it may seem like a lot of stories, and everybody that reads it, it tells me how wonderful and how they flow, and it reads more like an adventure novel than anybody's true stories. They say, I can't believe you did all that, which I did, and that was another reason I wanted it down, because people would often say, I can't believe you did all that, or sometimes they would seriously say, I don't think she's making that up, right? they didn't believe me, so I thought this way, at least I've captured the sum of the stories. But friends are saying, but you didn't say anything about your trip across the Pacific Ocean to the Marquesas, or the various boats that you had to build, or they go on and on about other things that, my life with Community Action Council isn't mentioned.
You've got a few more books than you.
Yeah, so there's lots more stories to tell. And at some point, I can envision going through this very same book and adding in sections in my own voice to enhance what's already there. But not right now. I'm still so busy.
Do you have an adventure going right now?
Well, life is an adventure, isn't it? We mentioned that. Uh-huh. Many kinds of adventures. In the simple get-on-the-road adventure, my husband and I got in a pickup truck and drove to Alaska and back last year, 6,400 miles, I believe it was, in a little camper in the back of the truck, which most people would say was a pretty good adventure. And it was. It was amazing. I mean, to be on the road, get all the way up there and go, oh, my goodness, I have to go all the way back. But also, there are the adventures in life that have to do with, still for me, helping other people. I mean, my husband has a disability. He's lost his hearing in the Air Force. We're both getting older, so we have some physical disabilities of a variety of sorts coming on. I have a dear senior friend that I'm helping, visiting, and kind of taking care of. Neighbor up the road just had surgery yesterday.
Like, wherever you are, you're very involved. And the lesson I'm taking, not only about writing from your book, is that when you don't have fear, when you don't have inhibitions placed on you by expectations, and you're free to live, there's an abundance of energy. That's what I'm feeling listening, like, how did you do all this? And I think it's because you weren't feeling restricted. And what I feel about writing is that writing is quite an adventure, because you never know what territory you're getting into. You've told us that when you recounted the story of being not saved by your parents but having to rely on yourselves, there was pain. When you recounted the story of Oklahoma City, there was pain. And I think that's another kind of adventure that comes too with writing, is the adventure of seeing into ourselves and our beings and the deep, deep emotions that we carry. And I want to thank you so much for sharing the book, whose title I want to repeat again, in the title of the book, which is available through the typical sources, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bookstores and online, Through Fire and Water, True Stories of Rita Marie Matteson.
Matteson,
okay. Not to be confused with other famous writers. And as told to Laura
Collender.
Thank you so much. And I want to be sure that people know how to get more information about you on your website. Would you tell us what it is?
I don't know the website. You can email me.
Okay. Would you tell
us that? Rita.Kepner@gmail.com. It's real easy. So okay. Rita.Kepner@gmail.com.
Okay. Because you might want to know more about the book and more about things you can do in your own community. You don't live far from us in Fort Townsend and Maristone. Things that we can all do to be of service. And also, I happen to know that there's some information about you on Amazon. So it's another place, an author bio. So thank you so much for coming in. I really, really enjoyed hearing the description of the book in your words and hearing the excerpts in your voice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, www.writingitreal.com/audio.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Production coordinator is Mike Schlexer. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.